This is the takeaway for Wednesday, June 1st, 2016.
This is the takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and they're back on the job at Verizon. Those sounds are gone. Who are we? CWA, the Communications Workers of America, one of the unions in the strike. About 39,000 Verizon workers are leaving the picket lines after 7 weeks on strike. Both sides emphasizing positives in this deal. Verizon says it's good for business and employees. The workers' new four-year contract includes more than a 10% pay increase, a promise to keep customer service jobs in the U.S., and an end to temporary shifts that would send workers far from home for weeks at a time. At the beginning of the strike back in April, Verizon executives were saying that union leaders were ignoring today's digital realities. And indeed, the strike appeared to be centered on the old landline business. But the most important development in the settlement might just be the way the union has successfully organized some wireless workers. 160 Verizon employees who worked at Verizon's wireless stores in Brooklyn and Massachusetts. Those workers voted to unionize in 2014 but have never had a contract until now. A small step, but a huge symbol of possible change to come. Bianca Cunningham is a former Verizon worker in Brooklyn and a union organizer at her store. She was fired from her job last September, has filed a grievance with the National Labor Relations Board claiming she was targeted for her organizing, but she's smiling today.
So what was achieved in this strike for Verizon Wireless was that we were able, after bargaining at the table with the company for over 2 years now, we were able to come out with a strong contract with good job security, really good just cause language, and some minor improvements in wages.
And how does that affect you personally?
So how it affects me personally is that now some of the money that was incentivized before in my job will now be guaranteed and rolled into my base salary, which of course is nice, right? I don't have to jump through hoops to attain that money. Also, it means that I have more job security. My coworkers have more job security, just cause language, and we're no longer at will employees. And when I do return to work, it won't be easy for them to fire me.
Now, describe that situation. I mean, they weren't particularly happy with your organizing of wireless workers, which is a huge challenge in the communications industry right now.
It's a huge challenge because I believe it's something new that organizing is going into, like, how do we organize retail workers? The schedule is erratic. It's not a Monday through Friday. There's not, like, the turnover is high. The union is significantly younger. How do we educate them about the importance of unions and what they've been able to accomplish for other workers in the past? And so we've just been trying to educate people and empower them to stand up for themselves and want better.
There was a real sense that the Verizon strikers were under the radar during the entire period that they were out. It was a rainy, messy, yucky time in the East during the spring. You would see them. There wasn't really much of a cause célèbre. How did you keep your morale up?
I think we were really empowered by the support that we've received from Senator Sanders during his campaign run. He's visited several picket lines. He's also picketed stores with me for my own job in Times Square, even last year before the strike was even on the table. I think we were also empowered by him shouting us out in the Democratic National Debate. Those are all things that make us feel like we're doing something right and bringing our cause to everyone's living room, like in their television. And I think that we also have received a tremendous amount of public support from people on the street, from people via internet. And so we drew off of their energy.
Now, a lot of people were saying, certainly a lot of academics were saying that it appeared as though Verizon wanted to break the union once and for all and just change its cost of doing business and get out of the landline business altogether. First of all, do you see Verizon getting out of the landline business? And if so, does that affect the ability to organize?
I think that what Verizon has been trying to do is enlist the subcontractors. Even if you look at like with the Fios installations, most of the people who were employed with them were from subcontractors. So what happens is that they're trying to replace the union workers with them and then initially freeze out, right, wireless from the union so that they don't have this problem in the future. We all see that. This is why they fought wireless so hard to even have a contract, and our wins were modest because they don't want to make it attractive for other wireless stores and other places to be able to want to join the CWA.
Is Verizon your enemy as a union employee, or are they collaborators in some model of prosperity?
I believe that Verizon can be our collaborators and are our collaborators, and that's the only way that we will effectively go organize other wireless stores going forward, is by us working together and understanding that how to live with one another.
Bianca Cunningham, where do you expect to go back to work?
We're waiting for the decision. It can be any day now.
And somewhere in Brooklyn.
Somewhere in Brooklyn, 86th Street stores where I used to work. So,
Bianca Cunningham is a former Verizon wireless employee in Brooklyn and a union organizer. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So Stephen Greenhouse now joins us, a former labor reporter for the New York Times. Welcome, Stephen.
Hi, John.
So we've just spoken with Bianca Cunningham, who's a reasonable-sounding labor organizer in the wireless space for Verizon workers. Does she represent some future of the labor movement in the United States, people like her? Or is she just a voice of the wilderness to be overwhelmed by circumstances and economic change?
Yes and no, John. The number of strikes in the nation has greatly declined from about 300 a year in the 1950s to about 10 a year now. So unions are rare because unions realize that they're very painful and companies have gotten much more sophisticated in beating them. However, the Verizon strike kind of had a different result. The union seems to have emerged largely victorious. It really held strong. It really hurt Verizon. Verizon, I think, expected the union to crack. Wall Street analysts say Verizon lost about $200 million because of the strike. It installed less Fios. Its Verizon Wireless brand was hurt. And I think what happened is, you know, the union was able to do better at the bargaining table than many people thought. Verizon canceled a plan to freeze pensions at 30 years. It gave a larger raise than it seemed to be intending. So Bianca, you know, while some might say, oh, she's an organ labor organizer and unions are obsolete, you know, this strike in ways showed that, you know, even today when unions are on the defensive, when they hold strong during a strike, you know, they could win real improvements and beat back demands for concessions.
Is the retail area where retail stores, Verizon retail stores and AT&T stores and elsewhere, is that a huge sort of untapped resource of workers for labor unions in this field?
Yes, in many ways. You know, the strike mainly involved so-called landline workers, you know, the old, you know, telephone at home, you know, where you hold the wire rather than wireless. But, you know, one of the breakthroughs here for the union, for the two unions that were involved, actually, was it for the first time won a union contract for nearly 70 wireless workers. And now that Verizon wireless workers, that some Verizon wireless workers have a union contract, that might encourage thousands of other Verizon wireless workers at retail outlets throughout the country to say, hey, look what those 70 workers got. They got better paid. They got better benefits. Clearly, the Communication Workers Union now is going to step up efforts to try to unionize dozens and perhaps hundreds of Verizon retail wireless shops across the country.
Where's the bottom here in terms of percentage of unionized workers? Have we reached it? Is the trend line going to go up ever?
This is the $64,000 question, John. The percentage of private sector workers and unions keeps falling, you know, every year or two. And unions are struggling to find out ways how to increase membership. And some are saying, you know, it's so hard to win unionization elections because companies fight them so hard. We have to find other ways to raise wages, raise benefits, rally workers. So we've seen, you know, this humongous Fight for 15 movement, which is not a traditional union movement. It's not, you know, holding unionization votes to try to get McDonald's workers to join a union. It's just rallied tens of thousands of workers around the country, and it seems to be pretty successful in getting some, you know, while McDonald's has not agreed to pay $15 an hour at any of its stores, the 5 to 15 movement has gotten, you know, Seattle, Los Angeles, San Francisco, California, much of New York State to agree to pay $15, you know, to pass laws that will require $15 an hour. And that is, I think, winning some support for the union movement. People say, look, the unions have done this for us, and maybe we should support the unions. Whether they vote to become union members is another question. I think unions are experimenting with new forms of rallying workers to win better wages and better working conditions.
Stephen Greenhouse is a former labor reporter for the New York Times and author of The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. Maybe not so tough looking ahead. Thanks, Stephen.
Thanks, John. Be well.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program, performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
Will there be a showdown over Israel and Palestine at the Democratic National Convention this summer? Candidate Bernie Sanders may be looking to force the issue.
There will never be peace in that region unless the United States plays a role, an even-handed role, trying to bring people together and recognizing the serious problems that exist among the Palestinian people. That is what I believe the world wants us to do. And that's the kind of leadership that we have got to exercise.
Well, if I want to add, you know, again, describing the problem is a lot easier than trying to solve it.
Sanders appointed two figures to the convention's platform drafting committee, openly critical of Israel, the well-known academic Cornel West and James Zogby, who heads the Arab American Institute. Here's what happened in 2012 when Democrats tried to reach consensus on the matter of moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem.
All those delegates in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those delegates opposed, say no.
No.
In the opinion of the... Let me do that again. All of those delegates in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those delegates opposed, say no.
No.
I guess I'll do that one more time. All those delegates in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those delegates opposed, say no.
No.
In the opinion of the chair, two-thirds have voted in the affirmative. The motion is adopted, and the platform has been amended as shown on the screen.
That's DNC Chair Antonio Villagrosa, who was speaking at the Democratic National Convention in 2012. Sarah Yerkes is a former officer of the State Department Office of Israel and Palestinian Affairs and is now a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. Sarah, welcome.
Hi.
What is looming for the Democrats in a discussion of Palestine and Israel right now, as you see it?
I think this is a really important and unique moment within the Democratic Party. I think Senator Sanders has really forced the party to take on an issue which is a pretty basic issue, kind of recognizing the dignity of the Palestinian people. Something that I don't think, if he were not still in the race, I don't think this would be on the table. I think he's really kind of pushed a discussion of an issue that hasn't been within the party platform in the past.
And what does that entail? Settlement freeze, non-recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital, and a two-state solution? Are those the basic principles that need to be explicit and laid out in the platform?
Yeah, I think one of the things he's been pushing is to label the situation as an occupation, Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory, recognizing Jerusalem as a potential capital of a Palestinian state as well as Israel, and then again treating the Palestinians with dignity is the term that he's been using, none of which is really a revolutionary idea. And all of these things actually have been longstanding U.S. policy. So sort of strangely, what the party is trying to do is to negotiate, discuss issues that have already been written into U.S. policy for many decades.
And that then makes it all the more of a puzzle why there should be a split. It's U.S. policy. Does the presence of Mr. Zogby and Cornel West on the platform committee, is that going to inflame things or is that going to get us closer to some sort of consensus?
I don't know if inflame is necessarily the right word. I think they will bring this issue onto the table. I don't think at the end of the day that the platform is going to change. And I think given particularly Secretary Clinton's longstanding support of Israel, she's been pretty clearly pro-Israel. So I don't think she's going to allow the platform to change. And I think the presence of these two individuals who might be more pro-Palestinian than pro-Israel are not enough to make any sort of significant changes to the platform.
Does the word occupation offend many Democrats?
I think it will offend some. But again, this is, you know, if you look at the State Department official reports that they are mandated by Congress to produce every year, there's a series of them, Human Rights Report, Religious Freedom Report, Human Trafficking Report. They've used the term occupation for decades. So this is not something new. So I think a lot of people don't know that. And some of the more centrist Democrats might be surprised and might not like that term occupation. A lot of people don't like that term occupation in the pro-Israel camp. It's really just trying, I think, in the end, to move the Democratic Party towards what has been U.S. policy.
In that case, if it is U.S. policy, and if all these things have been stated before, then a big battle with a lot of screaming and yelling, like was the case on the Jerusalem question in 2012, will give the impression to the nation that either there's some huge group in the Democratic Party that is against Israel or some huge group in the Democratic Party that's trying to manipulate matters to its own liking, a sort of pro-Israeli lobby that's trying to get language or keep language out of the platform that's actually U.S. policy. Neither of those are positive images for the Democratic Party, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting because what you're seeing, and I think this is playing out, is a real divide amongst the Democratic Party that you're now having, and polling has shown this recently, that you're having larger proportions of the Democratic Party, particularly of liberals who tend to be the people who favor Senator Sanders. They're less comfortable with an overtly pro-Israel U.S. policy. And so I think, you know, you have this portion of the party that's growing, and you still have, you know, I'd say probably a majority of the Democratic Party that would be fine with sort of the more pro-Israel stance. But what happens is you're going to have a debate. I mean, like any other issue, any domestic policy issue, I mean, this is something where there's no longer a consensus. I think there has been, you know, lobbying on both sides. And I think no matter how this turns out, and we'll see in July during the convention what happens, you know, but you will see this sort of that there is this is a contentious issue. This is a very passionate issue. And you're going to have people on both sides who are going to or on either side, I guess, who are going to come away unhappy. But that's all assuming this even makes it into the platform at all. And I think one of the things is, you know, when you start talking about U.S. policy towards Israel or towards Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it sort of subsumes everything. And we kind of forget that this is just one small issue. And there's only two individuals really on this committee who have expressed interest in this issue. It could be that they don't even get that far. I mean, it could very well be that the platform is far more focused on domestic issues and that they don't even get to the point where they're having this debate.
Certainly, that would be Hillary Clinton's preference.
Yes, absolutely.
Sara Yerkes is a former officer in the State Department Office of Israel and Palestinian Affairs and is now a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. Sara, thanks so much.
Thank you.
There is a tough crowd out there ready to condemn zoos when something like the killing of Harambe the gorilla in Cincinnati happens. Are zoos cruel and outdated? Are they essential to conserving endangered species?
I do not think that we should keep zoos as a form of entertainment.
Although I love seeing animals, I would much prefer that they close the zoos.
The person to blame here are the parents. That gorilla should not have been shot.
Why is no one mentioning the moronic parents who allowed a four-year-old to climb a barrier like that?
They should have never shot that gorilla. They could have used a tranquilizer gun. It would have been just as efficient.
You're still giving us your views, and you can continue to do so at 877-8-MY-TAKE. But there is a pro-zoo constituency as well. Dr. Dave Hone, a paleontologist and science contributor for The Guardian, joins me from London, England. Welcome, Dave.
Thanks very much for having me.
What do you think the principal value is of zoos, and is it different in the 21st century than it was in the 1800s?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's developed enormously. You know, some of the earlier zoos were, I mean, well, the real early ones, you know, going back into the 12 and 1300s were basically just a menagerie, almost just a status of power. What was arguably one of the first truly public modern zoos was what is now London Zoo. And actually that was done as a foundation for scientific research with the Zoological Society of London. So I think actually the kind of research thread has actually always been there. with the modern concept of the zoo. But obviously what they're most known for is quote unquote entertainment. I have a little trouble with that as a terminology because it implies, you know, some kind of exhibition beyond actually the animal simply being there and, you know, hopefully acting naturally.
Although the criticism has been made that in terms of species preservation, it's very rare that species bred in captivity go on to live in the wild, that they become a source of bred in captivity for captivity zoo stock.
Yes, it's absolutely true that obviously captive bred stock can become inured to a zoo and even actively selected for keeping those animals in captivity. But again, I would argue that that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be doing it in order to try and preserve them. And the fact that there are success stories, there are numerous animals which are only alive in the wild now because they were conserved in zoos. And there are also numerous animals which are only alive in zoos and are extinct in the wild. In an ideal world, yes, we could return huge numbers of animals to pristine habitats. Unfortunately, that's not the world we live in.
Both parties here describe themselves as animal lovers, the anti-zoo group and people like yourselves. Is there a way for them to coexist?
My personal take is that I don't have a particular problem with many, not all animals. Again, there are certainly some species which should not, cannot be kept in captivity, but being kept in a captive environment, the criticisms and complaints and things that usually come into animals being enclosed is usually that it's in some way unnatural or it inhibits the animal's freedom. Again, even giant national parks typically have a fence around them that some way, shape or form the animal's movement actually is limited. The reality for most animals is that their movement is in some way inhibited. They can't live where it's too hot or too cold or too wet or too dry. Many of them simply don't want to. You know, there are lots of animals which will never leave the few square feet that they were born in. Animals in the wild, it's not some halcyon paradise. These are animals which are at constant risk of disease, injury, death, you know, predation, being eaten alive, risk of not finding a mate, you know, huge amounts of stress from food and water resources and all the rest of that. And actually, you know, compare that to good zoos. Animals have a huge amount of space. They will never run short of food or water or a mate. If they get sick, they get veterinary treatment. You know, there is a good reason that very, very large numbers of animals have very long lifespans in zoos compared to the wild. And it's because they live relatively stress-free, happy lives. But I don't have a huge problem with the fundamental idea of animals in captivity in the vast majority of cases.
Finally, in the Cincinnati case, do you think they had a choice not to shoot that gorilla in your view?
I haven't looked at the details of the incident. I haven't watched the videos, you know, et cetera. I wouldn't want to comment on what the zoo did as a choice without knowing the animals. What I would say is, you know, I have some experience in animal behavior at some of the stuff that I work on. I have worked in several zoos in the past when I was much, much younger. And for animals like the large primates and, you know, larger mammals, where actually there's almost a ratio of 1 to 1, you know, you tend to have one or two keepers for every one or two animals. These people have probably worked in those with those animals day in, day out for years, if not decades. If they know and understand the behavior of their animal intimately, and obviously no one will probably be a greater advocate for the protection and you know, best care of that individual animal than the keepers looking after it. The impression I'm getting from what I've heard, again, not what I've seen or read directly, is that they agreed that was the best decision. Then you have to say that was probably the best decision in terms of saving the child's life. You know, there's an entirely different moral argument about how do you value endangered species and all the rest of it. But it's certainly true. Comments that I've seen out there, you know, an anesthetic is not like the movies. You don't hit an animal with a dart and it passes out in half a second. You get the dose wrong, you kill the animal anyway, or it just gets enraged because you've just shot it with a tranquilizer. Realistically, if the animal was in real danger, or there was a real risk to the child, you know, that is simply not an option. And your choice is, do we hope that the situation improves, or do we think the situation is about to improve or not?
Dr. Dave Hone is a paleontologist and a Guardian contributor. Thanks so much, Dave.
Thank you very much.
Zoo or no zoo? When was your last visit to a zoo? Tell us what it was like. Wisconsin. I think some animals are perfect and happy living in a zoo. I visited the zoo a couple of years ago. New Jersey. Not sure anymore. And this whole gorilla thing has been making me think more about it.
Kevin Sutton from Dallas, Texas. I think it's fine to keep animals in zoos as long as they're kept in a safe environment and that is close to their natural habitat as possible. There's so much we can learn from animals, and I think in many ways we're protecting endangered species by keeping them in a place where they can't be poached or otherwise harmed.
Zoos depress me. Animals in cages and stupid people gawking, idiot children climbing into cages, and then the outrage. It's all too heartbreaking. If they can be a haven for endangered plants and animals, then maybe. Last time I was in a zoo was about 12 years ago in Barcelona, and it made me cry my eyes out.
Larchmont, New York, I think we need harsh punishment for those who cannot control their children and cause the death of beautiful, majestic, critically endangered, peaceful creatures. 8778 My Take is our number. Comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway. It was the shot heard round the world at Lexington and Concord that signified the beginning of the U.S. War of Independence from the British Crown. It would not be the last shot, and long after the Revolutionary War, more gunshots told the story of a new nation. These shots were not heard round the world.
July 25th, 1844. The Baltimore Sun, shot by accident. A young man named Silas B. Howe accidentally shot himself on board the North America near Rochester on Friday last with a rifle he had loaded to kill squirrels. He was from Detroit, and in his pocket was a letter from his mother with this caution: Silas, be very careful of your gun.
June 22nd, 1874. The Rutland Daily Globe. A Kansas boy earned a nice Bible by committing 300 verses to memory, and then traded his Bible for a shotgun and accidentally shot his aunt in the leg. A fearful warning to aunts.
Are these strange, polite messages, non-criminal stories, a carefully researched art project, a history of this nation's relationship to guns, or do they represent something even deeper?
February 24th, 1916. The Red Cloud Chief. Headline, kept on ironing. Accidentally shot in the knee by her 11-year-old nephew, who was playing with a revolver, Mrs. Lillian M. Thomas continued to iron handkerchiefs. Her task finished, she notified a physician.
It was while conducting research for another book about religions that author Peter Manceau found these curious stories and embarked upon a unique study of the role of firearms in American society, as well as depicting a new nation growing up with a peculiar sense of fatalism. His new book is called Melancholy Accidents, Three Centuries of Stray Bullets and Bad Luck.
Told with this feeling of there's nothing we can do about this. Certainly they're told at a time when guns were much more, had much more utility in American life than perhaps they do now. And so the sense that guns would be in your home, hung above your fireplace, was natural. And the idea that having them there is also bringing the possibility of death at any moment into your home was natural as well.
It also says something. I mean, these are little pixels. It says something about the broader picture of America as a violent place, America as a place that is anticipating gunfire, you know, use of guns for other reasons. And these are just tiny little consequences of that larger violent society. What did you see? Because it yearns for a bigger picture, it seems.
The bigger picture I found in these stories has to do with the way we think about the role of guns in making the nation. The mythology of guns in American history is that we owe guns for our independence. Guns opened the frontier. Guns defended the homestead. They provided sustenance when you needed to hunt to feed your family. And all of those things are true to an extent, but this great untold story of guns in American history is the way in which they brought an unending hapless tragedy to those who kept them in their homes and in their families. And I think our current gun problem has to do with the stories we tell about guns, with this idea that is so common that we are all starring in our own action movie, and if we are the good guy with the gun, we'll be able to prevent bad things from happening, which ignores the volatility of these objects, the danger, and that's a great untold part of American history. I believe these melancholy accidents reveal.
But were Americans fantasizing about guns in the way we think about it today, or was it more, there was the gun, there's the hammer, there's the rake?
That's exactly right. There was a far greater sense of utility with guns. You need a family needed a gun in most cases, in a way that very few people need a gun now. They've become far more of a hobby object than they ever were before. And so you have a lot more today occurrences of people cleaning them in their living room while they're watching television, for example. They've gone from being a tool to being a way of defining one's masculinity, often one's Americanness, one's sense of freedom.
When you read this book, you really get a sense that the Second Amendment folks are right. I mean, this is America. There's nothing that's aberrant about guns if you can draw this line straight back to the American Revolution. Is what's going on today fundamentally different from what was going on in these stories?
Well, one way of thinking about it is thinking about this idea of gun control, what this phrase means. To many people, gun control refers to the control of guns by the state. But those who want to own and use guns want to own and use them to exert some sense of control over their lives. And I believe that's the real difference, that it has become now this totem of self-reliance in a way that it was not early in American history, specifically because it no longer has the same type of utility. It mainly has an imagined utility, imagining yourself walking through the supermarket and needing to be the good guy with the gun. That's a very different way of thinking about and using guns than going to hunt a duck to feed your family.
When did you first come upon the Coeur d'Alene story, the contemporary story of the little kid who pulls the gun out of the purse and blows his mother away?
Just as it happened.
In the news, right?
In the news, yeah. Yes. And seeing this story light up Twitter and spread so quickly, while I was deep in the work of collecting these gun accident reports from centuries before and feeling there was this immediate resonance, the way in which the story was told, with every detail making it feel like some kind of tightly crafted short story. The mother walks into the Walmart with her child and her gun in a newly acquired gun purse. Chekhov says if there's a gun on the stage in the first act, it's bound to go off in the third. That's how that story felt. And that's how the telling of so many gun accident stories feels. You watch it and waiting for the gun to go off. And it had direct resonance to all of these gun accident stories from the past. You learn enough details about the people involved to feel the poignancy of the loss, but often not any more than that. And so to learn more about the people involved, I had to do some further reporting to paint a fuller picture, as I do in the introduction of the book.
Did doing this research change you at all?
I did not grow up around guns. I do not own guns now. But doing this research made me aware of the ways in which gun stories were very important to me growing up. The mythology of guns, watching the A-Team and war movies when things are solved with guns all the time. I started to realize that I, too, though I've collected these reports that some would say make a political case against guns, that though that was not my intent, I, too, have been brought up and raised with this mythology of the good guy with the gun, and guns can solve problems. And collecting these reports, reading American history through them, reminded me that we are not talking about heroic self-reliance most often when we are telling stories about guns. Really, what's hidden beneath all of that is this hapless tragedy that happens again and again and again, but doesn't contribute to our sense of ourselves as freedom-loving, freedom-fighting Americans, and so often goes untold.
Peter Manso is a guest curator at the Smithsonian Institution and author of Melancholy Accidents, Three Centuries of Stray Bullets and Bad Luck. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Remember the summer of 2006?
If I told you things I did before, told you how I used to be.
That's Peter Bjorn and John with the 06 summer hit. Their new album, Breaking Point, is out next week. They stopped by The Takeaway and performed their latest single, Breaking Point.
In the European late October night, stay inside with your doubts. In the quest of what is worthwhile, or your stride on the couch, hypnotized.
Breaking Point might describe just how the band has weathered massive technological changes in the music business, and they've come back again and again.
We started with getting all the songs right, like tempos, keys, and forms of the actual song on an acoustic guitar. And then we went in and produced them and splashed color on them and make them shine, sort of. And we worked more like, less like an album, and more like 12 singles is how we approached the recording. So that's why we brought in a lot of like outside producers to kind of polish the songs, to kind of make them all, you know, rise to the occasion.
An album doesn't really mean anything anymore. Anyway, it's just a playlist. It's just a playlist of all the same artists.
Yeah, but yeah, I don't know. I think this is a good album, maybe because we treated it more as a best of, but then the album becomes stronger, you know. I care about albums, but we're all different.
Well, it doesn't make sense in the way that people listen to music and the way they download individual songs as opposed to albums. They mean less and less, even though that's the big event. A new band has a new album.
It's still a big event, and it's also a big event in the process of, I mean, you can, maybe if you see a painting by someone and you see only one, maybe he or her had like 25 as a, like a serial sort of thing, meaning something great, you know, and it's definitely important in the process, I think, what you're aiming at.
Politics in America is not boring right now. No. And some people describe in America anything Scandinavian as kind of boring and you know, we have a joke on public radio, you know, because all the Norwegians that went to Minneapolis and, you know, they make these jokes about Swedish and Norwegians and all this sort of stuff. But, you know, at times like these, when the politics in America are so, shall we say, not boring, what do you think about just going to live in Sweden if things get a little dicey here?
I heard.
Would that be a good thing?
I met someone yesterday who asked, like, oh, let me ask you, what taxes do you have in Sweden?
Really?
Yeah, and I'm like, well, we have 30% on that, and then you get more income, you get 20% extra. You know, it's going to become like Sweden, you know, that's the big
fear of
Bernie Sanders or something. So it was interesting, like, talking about that. And
so people wanted to go to Sweden to escape Bernie Sanders.
No, to escape him. But it's definitely a different mindset in Scandinavia compared to other places.
If the tensions between the U.S. and China, if a certain individual becomes president who's talked about like nukes and all this sort of stuff, can I just, you know, go to Sweden and get away from it all and be safe there?
There's a lot of space, a lot of forests.
Yeah, there is, right? Yeah. And nice Swedish people.
You're welcome.
Some of them.
Some of them?
Not everyone.
Not everyone.
No. I know one guy, he's not that.
Okay, just give me his address and I'm cool, I'm there. All right, thanks so much, guys. It's great talking to you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Peter Bjorn and John performing Breaking Point. Their new album is out on June 10th. In the quest of what is worthwhile, or you strive on the couch, hypnotized. It's a small step for humanity, a giant step for me. I've been waiting for your kick to set me free. Sudden Jesus, sudden Superman. Like any loser can. Be running on empty, I leave it all in your hands. Now show me what to do, I'm listening to you. Ooh.
You've been hiding in the bosom of my dream. Now the clock sets the scene. We've been eagerly awaiting your entree. What to do? What to say? All the trivialities are out of focus in my mind. All I really wish is you'll be doing fine. Sodden Jesus, sodden Superman. Got it from whiskey like any loser can. Be running on empty, I'll leave it all in your hands. Now show me what to do. I'm listening to you.
Catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.